Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Robert Okell about his study of the political and literary career of the 19th century British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli. Bob, welcome to the show.
Welcome. I'm very pleased to be here.
And we're pleased to have you here. Bob, I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm now a professor emeritus at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada, and a former dean of the Faculty of Arts at that university. But I taught for 44 years in the Department of English, Film, and Theater. And during that time, I spent a lot of my research time working on Disraeli.
I get the impression from your career that this has in some ways been a project long in gestation. Is that correct, or did you come about the book to write the book more recently?
Well, no, it has been a project of long gestation. I first got interested in Disraeli when I was in graduate school and I took a history seminar. And I found, as the professor was talking about the rivalry between Gladstone, that's William Gladstone and Disraeli, that much of what he said made a lot of sense. But I was curious because I knew that Disraeli had written some novels, and I decided to go and read a couple of them just as sort of background in the course. But when I read the novels, I realized that he was a much different figure from what I had come to think. And so I began to explore in my own mind what those differences from his perceived usual personality and what I discovered by reading the novels would have, what consequences that would have for thinking about his actual role in 19th century politics. But then as I got into that, I read more of the novels, and then I became interested in them as a scholarly subject as well.
That's one of the points that stood out when I read your book, which was that there seems to be some difficulty, especially from the side of British historians, in terms of coming to terms with his literary career. And I think at one point you talk about how they treat it almost as though there are two Disraelis.
That's very true. Before I answer that question, can I just say that one of the things about Disraeli that's really fascinating is that he achieves most of his life's ambitions over the decades of his life, despite a most unpromising sort of start. He is able to use rhetoric in such a powerful way that he's able to overcome almost all the liabilities that should have kept him from achieving any kind of success. I mean, the matter of his Jewish heritage is certainly an important liability in 19th century England, where the Jews were precluded from any role in politics until the 1850s, and subject to a great deal of prejudice and hostility. And on top of that, he had a very eccentric education. Instead, he was a very bright young boy, but he was not sent, as his younger brothers were, to a public school. He was sent to a very obscure private institution, and then turned loose in his father's library to educate himself. And those are significant liabilities when you consider what the background of most of the people who succeed in politics are. But I'll come back to his education and the consequences of his early behavior in a minute. But to take your point about the two Disraelis, it is very much true that historians have neglected the fiction by and large. And when they have tried to comment on it, they've settled for very easy things like plot summary and character summary, without really asking themselves, is there any kind of narrative pattern in these books? And do they have any connection to the life being lived in politics? So the theory that I came up with was that, in fact, the novels are all connected in some way or other to the matter of Disraeli's identity and to the particular moments in his political life that are most critical. And so I'm arguing that there is a direct and powerful connection between Disraeli's fictions and the critical moments of his political career. And as a consequence, to view Disraeli as a minor novelist who found his real success in politics, or as a politician and statesman who happened to write a number of quixotic novels, is really to misperceive the man. It's really essential, I think, to see that both endeavors, the fiction and the politics, express the same urgencies of his life. The novels served Disraeli as a means of exploring and coming to terms with both public and private aspects of his identity that are problematical, while the politics becomes a form of theater in which tensions and ambivalences of his character find ever more powerful expression in roles occasioned by ideological disputes.
And I think that gets to one of the things that makes him such a difficult figure to come to terms with, because there really is there's definitely is nobody like him before. And you think nowadays, where so many politicians do occasionally go into writing, or novelists who go into politics. I'm thinking, for example, of I think it's Jeffrey Deavers, one example, for whom politics seems to be more of a passion and a hobby rather than necessarily a career. And it, I think, accentuates that notion of, you know, you're either fish or fowl. You're not, you can't be both.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates, it fuels that misconception about Disraeli that you were referring to.
Well, one of the reasons why historians tend to neglect the novels is that they judge them to be very second rate. The early novels, the six or seven novels he wrote before he got into politics in any successful way, are really romances. And a lot of historians just see them as trashy, that they're not significant works of art. And so they want to neglect that. And then they have to deal with the trilogy of novels, Coningsby, Civil, and Tancred, which are overtly political in their themes. And they usually provide some kind of summary of that. But there's so much in the novels that is over the top, as it were, in the nature of the characterizations and in the nature of the narrative expressions, that it's easy to dismiss them unless you're convinced that they have some important connection, as I say, to Disraeli's identities.
I think it also doesn't help that in so much of academic training, we tend to put ourselves into certain silos. Historians don't necessarily get into literary study, and thus for them, the idea of analyzing a novel in the way that you've analyzed Disraeli's works is at the very least uncomfortable for them.
I think that's true. But I was a product of the interdisciplinary Victorian Studies program at Indiana University. And so I was encouraged to do both disciplines and others as well, and to try and deal with the differences in methodology and the differences in assumptions that underlie each of the subjects. And so I think that was a very important part of why I got interested in Disraeli.
I was wondering if we could go back now and talk a bit more about his early career, as you begun doing, in yeah. terms of his early years and how it was he came to start writing novels.
Let's talk about briefly about his childhood and adolescence and early young manhood. He started out with some liabilities, but he then went on to make almost every possible serious mistake. In doing that, he set himself up to be the easy target of people who wanted to dismiss him. He, for example, as a young man with this, as I say, very eccentric education, he got into some speculation on the stock market in the 1820s. I mean, this is about the age of 20. And he ran up some very significant debts, which he had no means of repaying. And these debts would come to plague him almost all of his life until he actually got to the point where he had significant donors and backers behind him. And that was so for several decades, he was constantly in very, very deep debt. And the debts kept getting ever larger because of the lax rules on interest and so forth on loans. So that was one thing that was certainly not in his advantage. And then he, in the 1830s, as he gets very interested in the idea of running for politics, he carries on an adulterous affair with Lady Henrietta Sykes, and did so in such a public way that again, his question of his moral character came up, and it seemed easy again to dismiss him as anyone likely to succeed in politics. Beyond that, he decided in his early 20s that he would dress in a very dandiacal fashion. He wore extravagant clothes. Curled his hair in ringlets and was all lace and ruffles and bright colors, when serious, sober people going into politics dressed in black. So, again, he was a figure of quite extraordinary difference from anything that the politicians had ever seen before, or for that matter, the general public and voters who were going to be the people he was appealing to get into the House of Commons.
He really comes across as a person who cuts a very dramatic figure, but it's not the sort of figure that was commonplace in politics. He's more of a Byron in terms of being very show.
And that's very true. He was very much taken with Byron. His father had actually met Byron at John Murray, the publisher's dinners, and Disraeli was consciously imitating Byron. I have a chapter in my book called The Byronic Legacy. Mm-hmm. And he even went so far to go on an extended tour of the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern countries, in which he followed Byron's itinerary for much of the journey. He saw himself caught up in the same psychology of Byron, that is, claiming to be a person of principles, but at the same time, when challenged or defeated in any way, developing a kind of scornful and cynical attitude towards the world. So it wasn't just the sort of clothes and the striking postures he would adopt, but also the psychological dimensions of his personality that were clearly modeled and shaped on Byron's reputation.
And yet, as you point out, that Byronic, well, for lack of a better word, pose, is one that's at odds with so much of his background and his appearance. You were talked about how the ideal at the time was tall, strong, fair-haired, and Disraeli, by contrast, is short and dark, and of course, coming from a Jewish heritage. So the pose seems much more of a pretense in some ways than it might have if he had been, say, if he looked like William Gladstone.
Very true. It's important to realize when I talk about his Jewish heritage that is a familial thing, but there's one very sort of strange a feature of Disraeli's youth, and that is that his father, who was a member of the Bevis Marks synagogue in London, had a quarrel with the elders of the synagogue and left the synagogue. And as a consequence of that quarrel, Disraeli's father decided to have his children baptized in the Church of England. And this was a stroke of incredible good fortune for Disraeli in one sense, because he was not eligible to be a member of the House of Commons as a Jew unless he had adopted a Christian religion by choice. And so that feature of Disraeli's youth made him eligible for a political career that he would otherwise not have had, because it would have, by 1858, when the Jews were finally liberated, as it were, from their liabilities, it would have been far too late to start. Now, the other thing about, well, that leads me to the core analysis of his character and personality. All his life, Disraeli was ambivalent about being both Jewish and a Christian. On the one hand, he was very proud of the Jews, and particularly historically. He was proud of his ancestry, although he fabricated various versions of that ancestry from time to time. But he was also very aware of what a terrible burden it was to be Jewish in the world of Victorian politics, because, of course, there was such terrible prejudice against the Jews. On the other hand, that's one side of the ambivalence, but the other side is that he was also convinced he was different from other people, and that difference wasn't just his heritage. He felt he was different in ability, in character, the word he used actually was genius. Mm-hmm. He felt himself superior to most people, if not all other people, and at least those he knew. And on the one hand, this led him to be extraordinarily ambitious with regard to his political life. So that ambivalence is something that comes up all the time in the novels. In virtually every novel, there is some form of this ambivalence, and it's there in the politics as well, of course.
Mm-hmm. This one of the when you were talking about that sense of genius, it also comes across in his early novels, the sense of a person who stands out, who shines, and who ultimately is rewarded primarily for their genius rather than their coming from the right background or mm-hmm. having, for example, the proper education and so forth.
Yes.
I was wondering if we could maybe then go back a bit and start talking about how he got into novel writing and some of those early novels.
Sure. Well, the one that is most intriguing is the very first one. Disraeli, as a young man, at the time he was beginning to speculate on the stock market and consequently to rack up very serious debts, he was an acquaintance, more than an acquaintance, a friendly acquaintance of John Murray, the publisher, who I already referred to as a friend of his father's. And Murray wanted to start a newspaper that would rival the Times. And this newspaper, which was eventually called The Representative, was something that he gave Disraeli a major role in setting up. Even though Disraeli, as I say, was just a very young man of 20 years old at the time. But the venture with Murray and his newspaper didn't turn out well. There were a lot of difficulties in trying to establish a newspaper, but Disraeli managed to alienate some of the other important players in the project. And in the end, he left the project in a somewhat state of disgrace, I suppose, with them. It didn't turn out well at all. But certainly while he was working on that project of establishing the newspaper, he had very large ambitions about what his role in life might turn out to be, a man of great power and influence in shaping public opinion and probably getting to be one of the leaders of political life outside of Parliament. But in any case, when it all ended in failure and collapse for him, he set out to write a novel called Vivian Grey. And Vivian Grey is a disguised version of the events surrounding the Representative newspaper. And it's a different story, of course. But in the novel, the hero, Vivian, attempts to manipulate a powerful political figure, the Marquis of Carrabas. Vivian is portrayed in a satirical way as a cynical opportunist in every way. And again, there's a lot of Byronic posturing in the novel. But it was a huge success of scandal because people could see right away that there were similarities to some of the characters, fictional characters, and people actually surrounding Murray and his circle of friends. And as a consequence, the publisher actually put out a key to Vivian Grey trying to identify each of the characters. But it was thought, it was published anonymously, so it took some time for the truth of who the author of this book was. But in the meantime, it was a very successful novel, albeit in the judgment of sober critics, a trashy one. It established Disraeli as somebody who had a certain amount of talent in the matter of writing fiction. And although it turned out, I think, to be, again, a liability in his political career later on, because people could go back and say, see, this is what he is. Mm-hmm. He's a cynical opportunist. He's got no sort of moral core. He's got no gravitas and so on. So that's how he got into politics. But at the same time that he was writing novels in the early years, he was doing so largely to try and raise some money to pay off these debts, or to keep even with them at any rate. So he wrote five or six more novels between 1826 and 1836, 37. And each time he was trying to write for money, trying to create. But each of those romances, nonetheless, has a fantasy structure, a pattern of characterization and development of plot that speaks to the ambivalences of Disraeli's own situation, of how he sees himself. That I think is what I bring to the study of the early novels that others have missed.
One of the other novels of that early period that really stands out is Contrini Fleming, and I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that novel in Disraeli's life and what he's trying to capture, what he captures in that of where he is at that point.
Yes, it's another novel where the whole dynamic is ambivalence. In this case, the hero, Contarini Fleming, and the very names themselves suggest a kind of ambivalence, Contarini being Italian and Fleming being very much an English name. But in this novel, the hero feels that he has a dichotomous heritage, that of his father and his father's world, and that of his mother and his mother's world. And in terms of their, and the father is a successful politician in a northern country, and his mother comes from Venice has an Italian heritage. And so Contarini initially has a great deal of success operating in his father's world and enters politics there. But he longs for a different kind of recognition, not the recognition of his genius, of his ability, but the recognition of a kind of maternal, all-embracing love that would be an acceptance of who he is without any demonstration of organizational genius or oratorical genius. And so the world, the novel involves Contarini going to Italy and there discovering his cousin, who seems to be an exact identical replica of his mother, who is deceased. And so you can see there again how the ambivalence plays out in the novel. The desire to succeed on the one hand through a demonstration of his superiority, largely in political terms, an oratorical superiority. And on the other hand, a desire for some kind of innate acceptance of his purity and his lovableness, and without any need to go beyond that. And those two kinds of ambivalences in his sense of himself are very strong in Contarini Fleming.
Now, at the time he writes these novels, they're serving in another purpose as well, which is that they are established, they're helping him to continue to establish his position in British society. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about their reception, especially among the elite, and how that played into both his affair with Lady Henrietta Sykes and also his friendship with Lord Lyndhurst and his eventual entry into Parliament.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the early novels, I think it's fair to say, did not do him much good in a political sense. Some of them were more popular than others, but I think people were quite quick to see them as less than impressive works of art. But of course, that's judging by a different standard, in a sense. The world of Victorian fiction is populated by thousands and thousands of these romances, as such, and Disraeli seems to be exploiting that genre. When he gets later on and he writes political novels, they're much more tightly structured, and they have an overt propagandistic theme and so on. But let's go back and look at him in the 1830s when he's still, as it were, trying to make some headway as a public figure of some notoriety, fame perhaps if you call it that, but more likely seen mostly in a negative way by those who have any class status or power, social power. A couple of the novels do relate directly to the kind of life he was leading. As a young dandyish figure, and the author of all these novels, he was invited places because of his extraordinary wit, his command of language, and his ability to be satirical and sarcastic, to entertain people with his commentary on politics. One of the features of that was his hatred of the Whig Party. He was always good value for your invitation when he came to dinner or to your evening soiree or whatever. He did inhabit that world around the fringes of the aristocracy because of his notoriety and because of his, as I say, his capacity to entertain people with his wit.
And that opened up possibilities for him, contacts.
It did. And one of the people, as you say, he met through Lady Henrietta Sykes was Lord Lyndhurst. And Lord Lyndhurst is a former chancellor of the Lord Chancellor of Parliament in the House of Lords. And Lyndhurst was a bit of a rakish figure himself. And he saw possibilities in Disraeli's ability and took him on as a private secretary. But Lyndhurst was one of the so-called ultra Tories, and he was interested in trying to resist the move towards reform. The Reform Bill of 1832 had already happened by the time Disraeli met Lyndhurst, but Lyndhurst was leader, as they say, of this group in the of the Tory lords in the House that was trying to resist any further encroachments on the status quo of the landed aristocracy. And so at the time of the Municipal Corporations Bill, Disraeli was acting as Lyndhurst's private secretary, and he was also writing a lot of quite scurrilous journalism for newspapers and pamphlets and things like that, trying to support the ultra-Tory position. Now, this is somewhat strange because Disraeli had been victimized by his previous attempts to get into Parliament. He ran twice in 1832, again in 1833 or 4, and then again in 1835, each time failing to win a seat. And in doing so, he tried to run as a radical, then as a Tory, then as a radical Tory, and radical again, and so on. And people were quick to point out how inconsistent all this seemed. In looking at that, I tried to see if there was any consistency at all in Disraeli's sort of identification of himself as a political candidate. And I think the thing that is consistent is he's always running against the Whigs, and he's taking whatever position gives him the best chance of being elected in particular contexts. As Lyndhurst's private secretary, again, he was quite an active journalist as well, and most of it was pretty fierce stuff with a lot of name calling and sarcasm and satire of Whig politicians. In a sense, that is part of the historical background. Another thing is that the affair with Lady Henrietta Sykes led to, when it finished, it lasted about 3 years and then it broke up. But Disraeli then wrote a novel called Henrietta Temple, which is a disguised version of the kind of emotional life that Disraeli was having with Henrietta. Again, it's a question of how to find both love and success while dealing with the tensions and ambivalences about both of them. A good example of how the life leads into the fiction, and the fiction is related to the life.
He does get into Parliament in 1838, and he is now a conservative or a Tory, and yet he's not really being rewarded at the level of his genius, if you will, or at least his self-appreciated genius. He's sort of at the bottom of a very large pile.
Yeah. It was actually the general election of 1837 with the accession of Queen Victoria to the throne. There was a new general election, as is the case when monarchs change. And by then, Disraeli had begun to serve the interests of the Tory party, which Lyndhurst had certainly helped create as a role for him. But he had fought a by-election down in Taunton in 1835. And then in 1837, he ran as a candidate in Maidstone, a constituency that sent two members of parliament, sent two members to parliament. And that election was interesting in terms of his life too, because he had previously met at a party given by Bulwer Lytton a woman named Marianne Wyndham Lewis, and she was the wife of a coal magnate from Wales, but who had gone into politics and was the other conservative member for Maidstone. And he was looking around for a new candidate who could run for the second seat, as it were, in that constituency. And Marianne Wyndham Lewis persuaded her husband to back Disraeli. He was a wealthy man, and Disraeli didn't have the kind of money that a campaign would take in Maidstone, which was quite a corrupt constituency. But Wyndham Lewis backed him, and Disraeli got elected, largely with the enthusiastic help of Marianne. And so he immediately got into Parliament, and he of course, as you suggest, he thought highly of his own abilities. But Parliament has its own sort of forms and rules and regulations, some formal, some informal, that make it difficult for brash outsiders to just crash the party, as it were. And so his first attempts at what he called getting the ear of the House were not particularly successful. In fact, the maiden speech was something of a disaster. He was hooted down by the Irish radicals because he had unwisely decided to speak on the legitimacy or illegitimacy of some Irish elections. But anyway, over time, he did master the techniques of parliamentary debate. And by 1841, when Sir Robert Peel was going to form a majority government, having won the election of that year, Disraeli fully expected to be in the cabinet, or at least to be given a very significant role in the government. And he'd been encouraged in this, no doubt, by his friendship with Lyndhurst, Lord Lyndhurst. But Peel actually had very little discretion about who he might appoint to the cabinet, because, of course, he had to deal with the people of real power and influence in the party. And he had a lot of aristocratic people that had previously served as cabinet ministers. So I don't think he ever really seriously considered that Disraeli should get such a place. But Disraeli saw it differently, and he was mortified and humiliated by being left out of Peel's cabinet. That led to a very different sense of strategy. He began to believe that some other way of getting into a leadership role in Parliament would have to be found. And strangely enough, it came along, because in making a few speeches about the things he believed in, the importance of the landed aristocracy, the role of the church in representing the people, and so on, he drew the friendship of other young members of Parliament who had similar views. And so this became the embryo of what's called the Young England Movement. The Young England Movement was a sort of ginger group within the Conservative Party. It took the license and freedom of criticizing their own party leaders. Over and over and over again, Disraeli and his friends, who were George Smythe, the son of Viscount Strangford, Lord John Manners, the younger son of the Duke of Rutland, and Alexander Bailey Cochrane, a Cambridge friend of Smythe and Manners, the group of them formed, as I say, this movement known as Young England. And they had a dozen or so other supporters, but they were the core of the group. They began to have an impact on how the Conservative Party was doing business by virtue of the critique they kept bringing to various actions and policies of Sir Robert Peel and his cabinet. So there's no doubt that Disraeli was motivated in part by revenge. you've neglected me. I'm a genius, and you're going to pay for it. And so there's a kind of zest in the Young England movement, but it partly comes from a disillusionment with the state of England and the state of politics. Peel was a moderate, and his moderate policies didn't impress Disraeli and his friends in the Young England movement as equal to what they saw as the crisis that England was going through. By the 1840s, they were known as the Hungry 40s because of the mass unemployment and the collapse of business ventures and so on. And the poverty was extensive among the working classes. And so there was a sense of crisis in the 40s manifested elsewhere by the development of Chartism, the working class radical movement, or the kinds of literature that Carlyle was writing about, Thomas Carlyle, urging a sense that somehow or other England had lost its way, and some form of very different policy and approach was necessary.
Now, you mentioned how Carlyle's writing and Disraeli's writing, that Disraeli was not informed by Carlyle. We can't find any evidence of it, but the fact that they both seem to echo a lot of the same concerns reflects that common atmosphere of the 1840s.
Yes, I think that's right. There's no evidence that Disraeli had read Carlyle before writing his own works in the 1840s, but certainly they had similar world views, although Carlyle expressed his differently. But there was a similarity, and people did speculate on how closely the two authors were in reading each other's works.
You mentioned go ahead.
I was going to say
that in addition to developing this Young England movement and it serving as a platform from which to criticize Peel's government, it also served as a source of material for the first of these three political novels he writes during this period. I was wondering if you could speak to those.
Yes, that's very true. The Young England, well, let me explain that the first of the political novels is Coningsby, and it's subtitled Or the New Generation. And Disraeli takes some of the ideas from the Young England movement puts them into the structure of a narrative in this novel, Coningsby. But the whole idea of Coningsby is that there needs to be a kind of heroic individualism in the leadership of politics. So Coningsby is the grandson of a powerful lord, a marquis in the Conservative Party, his grandfather thinks he should go into Parliament and just carry on, as it were, holding up the family tradition. But Coningsby has all these ideas about something new, something different, and he rejects the old style Tory politics, and he wants to see a national party created that represents all of the people, not just the wealthy and the powerful. And so that's how Coningsby gets started. And it's full of satire. It's a very witty novel, and if people want to read a Disraeli novel, that's the one they should start with. Well, unless you like Vivian Gray. But, but again, it's the same wit, it's the same satire, the same sarcasm coming through over and over and over again as he skewers one person after another in the novel, these fictional characters who are actually, again, based on observation of real people within the Conservative Party. And so Coningsby has this kind of interesting nature. It's great. It's really entertaining at the same time that it's seriously propagandistic. He's arguing for a particular approach, a particular view of politics that will reform things, not in terms of reform bills, but in terms of this kind of aristocratic leadership that a new generation of young men could bring to the party. Now, he got this idea of a renewed aristocracy from the works of Viscount Bolingbroke, who was a political figure and a philosopher in the early 18th century. And Bolingbroke had written a number of works, in one called The Patriot King and another on patriotism. And he urged a young aristocrat, Lord Cornbury, to develop precisely the kind of leadership that Disraeli, 100 years later, 120 years later, is advocating in Coningsby. So there is a historical link there. And it's interesting that Bolingbroke was very much the same sort of figure that Disraeli was turning out to be, morally suspect, but again, witty and ambitious and so on. So, but Coningsby as a novel has another feature. It has the fictional plot of the hero Coningsby and his circle of friends, but it also has interspersed among the plot of the fiction a series of chapters that are like little political essays, and these are the way in which Disraeli is able to make the novel succeed as propaganda, because people are given a kind of historical perspective on what he's trying to develop in the fiction as a romance of self-fulfillment.
And Coningsby is very different, though, from the other two novels that he will write during this period as well. That was one of the things that you talk about, which is that in some ways he's developing almost three different aspects of his character during this period.
Well, before I address that, let me just say that most historians and most literary critics before I came along saw the political trilogy as very different in nature from the earlier novels. But I've been able to show that, in fact, the political trilogy contain elements of the same fantasy structure that shaped the early novels. In all of them, too, so that there is a continuity in the romance portions of these novels that, again, has to do with Disraeli's own developing identity. Now, with regard to the differences among the propagandistic trilogy, the first novel, Coningsby, was deliberately designed to talk about the nature of political parties and the need for heroic individual leadership. I think he intended to go on into a subject about one of his other favorite topics, which is the importance of the church as representing those people who do not have any connection to actual politics, the poor and the working class who don't have the vote, who don't follow politics in the usual sense, but who nonetheless, whose welfare ought to be every politician's concern. And Disraeli believed that the church had a role to play in ameliorating the lives of the poor, but in representing them too in the world of power politics. And I think he intended to do more with that, but he simply ran out of time in Coningsby. By the time he'd got his novel written about the political parties, it was 400 and some pages long.
He had to put a stop to it at some point.
Yeah. So he then had in mind a second novel where he would talk about the church, and I'll come to that in just a moment. But after, when Coningsby was published, it was a huge, huge success. It took the political world and the social world by storm. And Disraeli became suddenly what he'd always wanted to be, a significant person within the realm of political discourse. So that led to a very interesting moment when there was a working men's institution in Manchester called the Manchester Athenaeum. And they were so impressed with Coningsby and with Disraeli's novel that they invited Disraeli and his Young England friends to come up to Manchester and be the featured speakers at their annual soiree. And this turned out to be, again, an absolutely marvelous success, because there were something like 3,200 people in the audience. It was a lecture and a dance following. And Disraeli was the featured speaker, but George Smythe and Lord John Manners also spoke that evening. But again, it was all reported in the press, and again, he seemed to be building not only a fame or a significance within the narrow political world, but in the wider public world, because this was reaching out to people who don't really have much in the way of direct involvement in politics. But although the Athenaeum was clearly, in part, a way of helping working class people gain an education, educate themselves. So, again, that evening at Manchester, after Coningsby had been published in that fall, Disraeli acquired a whole other level of fame and success. So by the time he comes to write his second novel, Sybil, it's subtitled or The Two Nations, The Rich and the Poor. By the time he comes to write that novel, he's got a kind of status, both as an author and as a politician. So he takes on the subject in that novel. He takes on the subject of religion, and in particular, the role of the church. This is the Church of England we're talking about, a Protestant church. Sybil is really, in my view, a religious allegory, in which Disraeli tries to show the kind of leadership that's needed for the working classes through the character of his hero, an aristocrat, Charles Egremont, who's the younger son of a lord. Actually, he's the brother, by the time the novel gets going, he's the brother of an aristocrat. That novel, too, is full of wonderful dramatic scenes, scenes of working class poverty, scenes of working class violence, scenes of political rebellion, Rick Birding in the agriculture sector when people were being driven to desperation by the collapse of the agricultural economy. Once again, Disraeli finds that he's written a novel that everybody's talking about. Everybody wants to read. I was writing a paper on an entirely different subject recently about Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett and their courtship romance. And in their letters to each other, they're talking about Disraeli. And Elizabeth Barrett says, don't stay up late reading Sybil. So in a sense, he's expanding his world in these political novels and finding an audience that's both educated and uneducated, people of wealth and people of poverty, people of differing political views, but everybody's reading Disraeli. It was a bit almost like the success that Dickens had when he started. Everybody wanted to read the latest novel by Dickens, but it turned out in the 1840s they wanted to read the latest novel by Disraeli. So once again, a very interesting novel, full of, as I say, striking scenes, interesting characterizations, real tension in the plot, and yet conveying a message, as I say, about the importance of the church as an institution in the lives of people who don't really have any access to political activity as such.
And yet the novels by themselves aren't going to bring him to power. And that's one of the things that I find fascinating about this period of Disraeli's life is as he's writing these novels, which articulate a political vision, he also is in the midst of all this political change with Robert Peel embracing the repeal of the Corn Laws and the schism that takes place within the Conservative Party, which paves the way for his assumption of leadership in the House of Commons and eventually his ascent to the premiership in the 1860s.
Very true. If we're going to talk about the Corn Law debate in 1846, it's important to realize that Sir Robert Peel, when he had been elected with a majority in 1841, had run on a protectionist platform. That is, he had run defending the Corn Laws. The agricultural distress was so bad by the mid-40s, the consequences in terms of the poverty of agricultural workers, farmers, landowners, was so great. The consequences were so great that Peel began to think that he should change his mind. There had been something called the Anti-Corn Law League, based on a bunch of economics advocates who were arguing for free trade. And that's essentially what the debate is about. Are you going to have duties on the importation of corn, which is really wheat? It's the English word for wheat in the 19th century. Are you going to have duties on the importation of wheat, or are you going to allow the market to take its own way and allow England to import very significant quantities, which would have the effect of undermining, excuse me, the price of wheat that that local landowners could get for their crops. But in any case, Peel became convinced eventually that the Corn Laws couldn't be maintained. And so he decided that he would have to bring in a bill to repeal them. And this had always been a policy that the Whigs were prepared to undertake, but the Tories as a party had never seen that as their goal. And indeed, when Peel decided to repeal the Corn Laws, it was widely thought that he had simply betrayed his own party. And Disraeli, the ultra Tories and the Tory land, large Tory landowners, were hostile to Peel's measure. And Disraeli had decided by this time that there would never be a place for him in a cabinet of a government run by Sir Robert Peel. It was quite clear that for all his fame and success as a novelist, and for his success in speaking in Parliament, there wasn't going to be any lessening of the prejudice against him. So I think he came to the conclusion that the only way he was ever going to get into a position of authority and power in the Conservative Party would be to destroy Peel's ministry. And he sets out to do that. And he launches a series of attacks, vitriolic attacks, really, really bitter attacks, although often witty, on Peel throughout the Corn Law debate. And he galvanizes the opposition to Peel's measure of repeal. Amongst the Tory squires and the Tory lords and other members of the party. And basically two-thirds or three-quarters of the Tory party did not support Peel's idea of repealing the laws. But the Whigs, of course, did. So you had a crazy situation where the opposition would carry a bill for a Tory prime minister, even though his own party was, the majority of his own party was against it. But Disraeli knew that this opposition that he'd been able to, as I say, organize and galvanize would mean the end of Peel's career as a prime minister, at least for the moment. And sure enough, after the repeal was carried, the very next bill was a bill on Irish security in Ireland. And there, the Whigs were in opposition as well, and the Tory party voted against Peel, and he was forced to resign. And out of that came, as you say, the split in the Conservative Party that would really never be healed, because Peel and his supporters, among whom had been William Gladstone, all took a different route. They all became what were known as the Peelites, and gradually over the next decade, they came closer and closer and closer to the Whigs until they actually merged and formed the Liberal Party. Meanwhile, the ultra-conservative side of the Tory party went its own way and spent basically two decades in the wilderness of politics in opposition. They had three very short minority governments in that period. But they never won a majority election. And Disraeli had to find his way in that Conservative Party, which had, in a sense, found itself outside the realm of probable government because of the split in the party. So, yes.
And Disraeli's rise to power comes about as a result of this, but of course with this you have the decline of his literary output. He does three more novels over the course of his career.
Yes, well, politics becomes all engrossing. If you're going to, what happened was that when the party split, there was a struggle for leadership of the party. It was pretty much agreed that Lord Derby would lead the party, but he was in the House of Lords. So he needed a leader of the party in the House of Commons. And there was a real struggle for that. And many members of the party, although they had voted with Disraeli against Peel's Corn Law, had no intention of having Disraeli take over the leadership of the party in the House of Commons. And indeed, it's at this point that the anti-Semitism that he faces becomes really nasty. And you get the most egregious examples of people commenting on Disraeli's character. Now, you must admit, he gave them lots of ammunition in his early years, right? Mm-hmm. The debts, the affair with Henrietta Sykes, the inconsistent jumping around from party to party, and then plus all the barbs in his critique of Peel's government in the 1842 to 44 period, and the critique implicit in Coningsby, all of that weighed against Disraeli in the minds of these ultra-Tory conservatives. And So it wasn't an easy struggle. The one thing he had, though, was the ability to speak, the ability to make speeches and to carve out arguments that were very persuasive. And in the end, there was nobody else in the party who was capable of leading the party in the House of Commons, because all of the good speakers had gone with Peel. Mm-hmm. All of the cabinet ministers and things like that had gone with Peel, and were, you know, drawing ever closer to the Whigs sort of ideology. And so Gladstone went that way and would eventually become the leader of the Liberal Party once the Whigs and the Peelites had coalesced. Meanwhile, Disraeli, as I say, was the only officer still standing on the battlefield, as it were, after the split in the Conservative Party. So the fight for the leadership was prolonged and difficult, but he eventually was given that leadership, although there had been talk of combinations as the process went along. But in the end, nobody else was even remotely as talented as Disraeli, as capable in debate as he was. And so he ended up as the leader in the House of Commons under the general leadership of Lord Derby in the House of Lords. But as I say, it was a party in opposition most of the next two decades. And it wasn't until the 1860s that Disraeli's leadership of the House of Commons was so impressive and so obviously deserving that he took over as Prime Minister when Lord Derby, who was temporarily Prime Minister again with a minority, when he had to retire for reasons of health, Disraeli was finally able to become Prime Minister. But in those years of opposition, he had three times served as Chancellor of the Exchequer in these minority Conservative governments led by Lord Derby. And so he had, in a sense, had some real influence in shaping the policy of the government, and he was a very prominent figure by the time the mid-1860s came along.
But the last three novels he writes have to come at points where he has the luxury of time away from politics. Tancred comes out in the immediate aftermath of the Corn Law Crisis. And then he writes Lothair and I believe it's pronounced, how do you pronounce it?
Endymion?
Endymion. Are both written between his periods as prime minister.
That's right. And That's because the demands of leadership become all engrossing, and there isn't time to take any time off. But every time there's a kind of lull in the demand for political action, he turns back to fiction to comment on or develop some kind of understanding of what the politics has been about or will be about.
And as you point out in the final chapters, there a lot of the same themes from his earlier works continue forward.
Oh, yes, yes. One of the features of Disraeli's political life is that he was always prone to conspiracy theories. And he was always ambivalent about Catholicism. This goes back into the very early novels and the years of the early political struggles in the 1830s. He was often sympathetic to individual Catholics and even to Catholicism as a religion, but he hated Catholic politics and he hated the papacy. And so he was always prone to developing a conspiracy theory about Catholic politics and papal influence. And that shows up certainly in Lothair, which is written after he was first prime minister in 1868. That was a minority government, And he was on the defensive from the very beginning because Gladstone had introduced resolutions calling for the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland. And so Disraeli knew he was only going to be prime minister until the next general election. It would have to be on the new franchise after the Reform Bill of 1867, and which Disraeli had engineered so magnificently. But in a sense, when he's driven out of office by that election in 1868, he has time on his hands, and he reflects back on what he saw as a betrayal of his Irish policy, his attempt at an Irish policy in 1868. And he had fought the election on what he called the great Protestant struggle, that is, the need to defend the Church of Ireland, because that was the thin edge of a wedge against the Church of England. And so you see some of the early themes and early ambivalences coming forward again in the later novels. That's just one example, but there are others.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. Can I just add one thing first, though?
Sure.
I think one of the things that I talk about in the book at the end is Disraeli's really remarkable relationship with Queen Victoria. She had not been impressed with Disraeli as a politician in the first instance, but she was persuaded that Disraeli was actually somebody who was good for the monarchy and defended the rights of the monarchy by her husband, Prince Albert. And then after Prince Albert died, Disraeli was very close to the Queen in terms of his sympathies about her loss and about the burdens of carrying on without Prince Albert's help. And so gradually over time, he became her favorite prime minister, so that when he had a second ministry in 1874 to 1880 and was so involved in foreign affairs, about which the Queen knew quite a bit, that relationship blossomed into almost a kind of reciprocal best friends forever kind of relationship. That's a significant feature of his success in foreign policy at the time. Now, with regard to what I'm working on now, having finished the Disraeli project, I got interested in the larger question of political rhetoric in the 19th century, and that's what I'm working on. I'm trying to do a study that compares the language of Parliament, of politics in Parliament, with the language of politics as it's used in newspapers, and compare, again, both of those to the language used in novels and fiction when they are discussing politics. And I've got a central thesis, which is that legislation lags public opinion, and public opinion is shaped by rhetoric and by the command of rhetoric. And so I'm not just looking at Disraeli anymore. I'm looking at all the different political parties and the major political figures. So I've got a huge project that will keep me busy for some time to come.
It sounds like quite a project. Well, Professor O'Kell, thank you very much for taking time to be on the show today. I look forward to reading your project when it comes out, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you very much.